To Saudi Arabia? What could go wrong? I mean, it's just to generate electricity in that oil-rich, sun-drenched country, isn't it? But then you hear a genuine expert who explains...
The Prince of Saudi Arabia has made no secret whatever of his intentions that if Saudi Arabia can develop a nuclear power program, they intend to use it to make of the spent fuel nuclear weapons. What you're talking about is the United States playing a direct role in starting an arms race, a nuclear arms race in the Middle East.
And there you have it. Well, when you learn how much nuclear danger is being exponentially expanded, for profit, of course, then you get that sinking feeling from understanding the terrible nuclear seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, Ohio environmental trial attorney Terry Lodge explains what's behind the U.S. push to sell nuclear reactor technology to Saudi Arabia, as well as the dangers posed by a new proposed nuclear energy park in Ohio. And no, this is one park that's not being done by Disney. And to take meaningful steps to stop nuclear reactors, we will have an extended interview with Susie Snyder of Don't Bank on the Bomb. She'll explain how to get your bank or pension fund to divest from nuclear weapons manufacturers. It's easy, it's fun, you can do it during COVID. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than you will ever learn from an executive order. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 11, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting with some good news from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. On August 9th, the 75th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki, ICAN announced Caribbean state of St. Kitts and Nevis has ratified the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Joining Ireland, Nigeria, and Niue, which announced their ratifications on August 6th, the anniversary of Hiroshima, that means only six more are to go before the treaty enters into international law. In South Florida, at the Turkey Point Nuclear Generating Station, maintenance staff said they'd performed upkeep on critical pieces of the reactor, but inspectors at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have found that the crews hadn't done the work. Instead, they just filled out the paperwork. In Minnesota, at the Prairie Island nuclear facility, Xcel Energy temporarily stopped load-following operations after the NRC determined in a June 30th inspection that plant procedures should have required further analysis due to long-term effects on safety. Control rods used to shut a reactor are no longer deployed for load-following after a certain number of years and could be unable to perform safety functions and/or complicated plant shutdown. China has announced that it can launch nuclear counterattacks within minutes using its latest nuclear weapons. And now...
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
The United States is looking to build nuclear power plants for the moon and Mars. Yes, not content with having radiologically contaminated the Earth with deadly radioactive waste products from nuclear reactors and the entire nuclear fuel cycle, now the Department of Energy wants to spread it even further. as a man-made element that does not exist in nature. Plutonium is humanity's messy, indelible, smeared thumbprint on the heavens. And we are not shy about marking our territory with it, just like any randy dog marks its territory. Already, on Mars, we've left behind plutonium that powered the Curiosity rover, and we've dumped 72 pounds of plutonium on Saturn from the space probe Cassini. Contaminated the cosmos before we even know what's up there? With a radioactive half-life of 24,000 years that remains dangerous for 500,000 years? Thanks, Brainiacs at the U.S. Department of Energy, and here is your well-earned
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Here's the first of two featured interviews. 2 weeks ago, on Nuclear Hot Seat number 475, I interviewed Ohio environmental trial attorney Terry Lodge. That's where he detailed the Ohio nuclear bribery scandal and the current spate of nuclear bailout fraud cases breaking in Ohio, Illinois, and beyond. But Terry had so much more information to offer, we kept talking. And that's today's interview. Terry Lodge has been an advocate for the public interest in energy policy issues, has litigated nuclear power safety and environmental issues for over 40 years, and knows where the metaphoric bodies are buried. We spoke on Saturday, July 25th, 2020. Terry Lodge, welcome back to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Libby.
One of the issues we didn't have a chance to talk about last time has to do with the International Development Finance Corporation, or IDFC, which has shifted into using some of its $60 billion of taxpayer money to underwrite the export of small modular nuclear reactors. First of all, explain, what is the IDFC, the International Development Finance Corporation? What is it supposed to do, and what is it not supposed to do?
The IDFC was just created, I'm thinking, in about the last year to year and a half, but it actually is the successor agency to the old USAID Agency for International Development Agency, which was the kind of the keystone foreign aid apparatus and bureaucracy, if you will, that manages both the shipping and licensing and planning for everything ranging from humanitarian problems to regular trade. The thrust of USAID and now the thrust of the International Development Finance Corporation is supposed to be to help promote and elevate impoverished populations in other countries around the world. USAID has been controversial down through the decades. It's existed since, I think actually it's a JFK era innovation. But USAID was accused of being a CIA front, of being, you know, propagandistic. And I'm not denying the probable truth of those allegations. But in any event, it was controversial in that way. The IDFC was created essentially to provide more of a financing vehicle than previously had existed. While there will be, I suspect, conventional aid earmarked by Congress, the thrust seems to be far more in the direction of beefing up our imports. This was a Trump administration initiative. It's been kind of obscure, and it isn't, in a conventional politics way, very controversial. Making more money, making more imports, balance of payments, those kinds of things are perceived as desirable ends for the Congress to be ordering the executive. So the change is this, that the IDFC adopted all of the lending practices that were practiced by the USAID. USAID also administered a large loan underwriting kind of program, and all of the lending practices were essentially followed by the new agency, including putting priority on projects with humanitarian aims, putting priority on alleviating poverty and public health disasters, that sort of stuff. However, the big change, which was the result of a report generated by a study group in 2019, was it's time for the prohibition that had existed for 60 years against financing anything to do with nuclear power technology to be revoked so that the agency could now use some of its approximately $60 billion a year of lending authority to underwrite the export of small modular nuclear power reactors. That's a big deal because I'll call them SMRs. Small modular reactors are being peddled as the next generation. We presently have large, as I've alluded to before, sort of dinosaur light water reactors, mostly in the United States. SMRs are supposed to be more nimble, much smaller. They actually use a different kind of fuel cycle, which is far more dangerous and lends itself to potential for trafficking in nuclear weapons material. So it's a big deal.
This has been one of the factors behind the push to sell nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia.
Correct. And in fact, what has happened is that the IDFC announced this change in their lending rules, and I was able to work with a couple of people, and we attracted about 45 or 50 organizations to oppose it, and we submitted comments 2.5 weeks ago. There was a little bit of other opposition, but this is a pretty obscure issue, and literally, they're changing two lines in their lending procedures manual. The two lines basically saying you can now underwrite nuclear technology export. And so on Friday night, in an obscure notice, the IDFC announced that they were adopting the new rule, and so they're going to do it. So Michael Flynn, the notorious Michael Flynn, retired Pentagon general, who was supposed to be the national security advisor, the first one to President Trump, literally in the period of time after the election in November 2016 until he was to take office in, I believe, February or late January of 2017, Flynn was a registered lobbyist who was very busy lobbying his new boss to bypass a mandatory provision of the Atomic Energy Act that requires an act of Congress to approve the export of commercial nuclear power technology. Specifically, and this is according to a congressional, pretty deep congressional investigation, in any event, Flynn was lobbying along with a couple of other CEOs from about 7 or 8 different American firms, basically saying, we're going to get shut out of the export market for small modular reactors. We really need to get on this. And Mr. President, the best way you can help is by approving without congressional approval, just bypass the congressional approval process so that Saudis can begin receiving nuclear technology and fuel.
And this was specifically aimed because of the Saudis, correct?
Yes. That was the primary example that Flynn was citing. And this, of course, comes contemporaneously and somewhat after the murder of Khashoggi, the journalist at the Saudi embassy in Turkey. Very scandalous, notorious, globally sensational, horrible crime. Maybe we should back up. The prince, MBS, of Saudi Arabia has made no secret whatever of his intentions that if Saudi Arabia can develop a nuclear power program, they intend to use it to make of the spent fuel nuclear weapons. And it's supposedly, he's saying it as a counterweight to Iran. But what you're talking about is the United States playing a direct role in starting an arms race, a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. So it's really serious. Saudi Arabia, of course, is one of the most conservative to reactionary monarchies in the world, an extremely repressive government operated, overseen by a small handful of operatives, and they have, of course, a great deal of money, largely from oil fortunes. So they have undue control and sway and unaccountability. So let's move into a little bit more discussion about small modular reactors and how that this is a really dangerous sign. Small modular reactors require fuel that is enriched far higher than light water reactors. Light water reactors require uranium U-235 enrichment to about 2.5 to 3%. So when the fuel goes into the reactor, fissioning occurs, and that ultimately becomes very dangerous radioactive waste, but the energy is extracted and electricity is made. SMRs require enrichment up to about 20%, just shy of 20%, and The reason is that one of the more popular designs, there are several. One of them is the so-called thorium design. Radioactive thorium is not a very high energy material. It requires a kickstart from plutonium or uranium-233. U-233 is weapons usable uranium. It's very high energy and it's dangerous to handle. Plutonium, incidentally, is not very dangerous to handle and, of course, is a key element in thermonuclear weapons. But these two materials, one or the other has to be present in order to start off the process of fissioning in a small modular reactor. What you get at the other end is electricity, of course, but you also have even more very dangerous radioactive waste from which the U-233 and or the plutonium, depending on which material you used, can be recaptured and made into nuclear weapons. Of course, you can make it into nuclear weapons without running it through the fuel cycle, and having the nuclear power plant complex available on site is, if you will, cover for the production and ownership and use of nuclear weapons material.
So this would be a weapons-wise nuclearization of Saudi Arabia, making it potentially the 10th country to have nuclear weapons, and to then have them available in the Middle East, where there's Israel as well as Iran, so who knows where they would be aiming it.
Yes, and let me tell you a little element here. Section 123 of the Atomic Energy Act is the law that requires congressional approval of any export. One of the conditions is that whoever receives the exported material, and we're talking about here's some enriched uranium, they have to sign onto the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they have to set up what's called a system of safeguards. They basically have to consent and participate, as Iran is participating, in the system of International Atomic Energy Agency inspections to just make sure that nobody is diverting material to make nuclear weapons. It's important. It's federal law, with criminal backups to it if violated. And I don't think there should be any nuclear weapons material ever exported. So I think it's horrendous to even contemplate it. But if you're going to do it, you have to do it according to this framework. So when you go to President Trump and say, Mr. President, we just want you to bypass Congress, what does that do? You're talking about giving Saudis the unaccountable means to make the bomb.
Where does this stand now in terms of, has something been passed? Has something been rescinded? Is this still in play?
Interestingly, the prosecution of Michael Flynn derailed everything. He is part of a larger lobbying firm, which, as I understand it from the congressional report, continues to probably lobby, but Flynn, who was, of course, being prosecuted for a traffic ticket compared to trying to get the president to violate the Atomic Energy Act, Flynn basically has not been able to do this kind of thing. But it's sort of interesting that this is a very, very troubling direction that Flynn was pursuing. And, you know, all of the focus has been on the traffic ticket prosecution. Not to demean the prosecution, but it wasn't, in my mind, anywhere near the seriousness or significance of foreign policy and whatever standpoint. So far, there's a problem with that. But things are moving apace in trying to subsidize and encourage the development of a domestic small modular reactor industry. In Ohio, for instance, there's a federal installation in southern Ohio that has received in the last 8 or 9 months a Department of Energy contract to start enriching uranium up to that nearly 20% threshold level for small modular reactor fuel. And there is pending legislation in the Ohio General Assembly that has passed one of the two houses and is being spearheaded and pushed by rather the same cabal that is involved in the ongoing bribery conspiracy scandal in Ohio to create an Ohio research and development park for small modular reactors. The problem with the small modular reactor technology is that it includes and depends upon so-called reprocessing, nuclear waste reprocessing technology. The people who are pushing House Bill 104 in the Ohio Senate right now want to develop a thorium reactor, and they are actually saying in witness proponent testimony that if the bill passes, they will immediately move to take over, if they start setting up the project, all of the spent nuclear fuel from Davis-Besse nuclear power plant and the Perry nuclear power plant. This is the most dangerous radioactive waste in the entire commercial nuclear cycle. Their aim would be to reprocess it, which is a very messy and dangerous chemical continuum, and to glean the plutonium and the uranium-235 from it, and also U-233, such as it is generated somewhat in commercial nuclear power plants. So they're talking about that kickstart fuel. We need this kickstart fuel to make our thorium reactors work. Sure, it's nuclear weapons usable. And yeah, especially with U-233, it's very, very dangerous and all that, but that's what we intend to do. So this is mindless. Nuclear reprocessing resulted many years ago. There was the one and only nuclear reprocessing plant in the United States was in West Valley, New York. It operated for several years. It ended up generating, I think I read somewhere, 600,000 gallons of highly dangerous liquid radioactive waste, contaminated an industrial site, and there is some small remediation going on, but it is estimated that it will cost anywhere from $9 billion to $27 billion to clean up. Just clean it up and move the waste out to Clive or WCS in Texas, or Clive in Utah, one of the other low-level radioactive waste dumps. So the only reprocessing plant ever was a worker contamination nightmare. It generated 10 to 20 times the volume of waste that it started with. Basically, they take spent nuclear fuel, as I indicated, and try to glean isotopes from it. So you're talking about massively, dramatically, by several degrees, increasing the amount of waste that you'd be generating in a dangerous way. And you're creating or gleaning material that would be extremely marketable illegally in nuclear weapons trafficking around the globe.
What do we do to stop this one?
Among other things, I have been soliciting sign-ons for opposition testimony, we call it. I've drafted, in conjunction with some other people in collaboration, a letter, and we're trying to also get what people we can to come to Columbus when there is opposition testimony being taken by the Senate committee that is hearing this bill. We're very concerned, interestingly, this new scandal, the bribery scandal, may actually allow such things like this to proceed in invisibility, because all of the media focus is elsewhere on the, you know, this terrible bribery thing. The Senate is, so far as we can see, still plowing ahead. They had sponsor testimony from the state rep who sponsored it just last Tuesday. Sometime, we figure, the next week or two, they will accept what's called proponent testimony, which means that the execs from the company will come in. And then very shortly after that, maybe 2 to 3 weeks from now, will be the opportunity for opposition testimony. So we're trying to submit a letter with maximum numbers of sign-ons across the country, because this, to me, is a national issue, because we're talking about creation of a federally subsidized energy park for small modular reactors that a few people are going to make a great deal of money from, but the public stands to really lose a lot.
What do you need in terms of sign-ons? Who can sign on, or what organization? And if they wish to join you in this, how do they contact you? How do they sign on?
They can contact me by emailing me at LodgeLaw, LodgeLaw, my last name is Terry Lodge, LodgeLaw@yahoo.com. I will send them information, send them the draft opposition letter, and we can kind of take it from there. We also are anticipating doing a larger national kind of publicity push, but the details on that are pretty sketchy right now because, as I say, of the things going on in the General Assembly and how to get media attention moved a little bit beyond the House Bill 6, the bailout scandal. Interestingly, I might add, a lot of the same politicians that figured into the House Bill 6 being railroaded through the Ohio General Assembly have also voted for this, or in the Ohio Senate are likely to vote for it. And this isn't one-to-one identity. It is a nuclear industry initiative, if you will, but it's a different new fraud. I think that the whole technology push is absurd. I'd like to also say SMRs are not commercially available yet, and they are not anticipated to be for possibly as long as 15 years. And the Pentagon is interested in a variant, a smaller version of small modular reactors, which they have actually talked about installing at remote bases and using for however long the base exists, and walking away and leaving it, fuel and all, irradiated mess and all. So it's, again, an issue that is quietly going on beneath the radar of the pandemic, of Black Lives Matter, social justice, very necessary changes. It's taking advantage of the shadows where the media is not spending very much time. And it's a complex topic and appears to be sort of a eyes glaze over, isn't this just a technology of debate kind of topic. So this is bad, pretty disturbing when the regulators are hell-bent and the legislature are hell-bent on sailing it through as quickly as possible with as little visibility as they can muster.
And thus creating a genuine hell.
Yes, very, very true.
Terry, the breadth and the depth and the precision of your work is mind-boggling. You've certainly given us a lot to think about. Stay in touch, keep us informed, and thank you once again for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
Ohio environmental trial attorney Terry Lodge. To learn more about the recent arrest of five members of the Ohio legislature, including the Speaker of the House, on charges related to the bailout of First Energy's Ohio nuclear reactors, check out Nuclear Hot Seat 475 from July 28, 2020. We'll have this week's second featured interview, an extended talk with Susie Snyder of Don't Bank on the Bomb on how to get our money out of supporting nukes, in just a moment. But first, the outpouring of love and support in the wake of the Hiroshima Nagasaki 75 anniversaries was beautiful to behold. It seemed that there were more than expected articles in mainstream media to counterbalance the pro-nuclear drumbeat. For this one brief moment in time, the balance of information shifted, and there were a wealth of stories supporting the opposition of nuclear weapons, giving its victims voice. I'm still catching up with what was published and what was put on live stream, and it's heartening to hear from so many others who share a thoughtful, heart-filled opposition to all things nuclear. But that was just for one 10-day period. In conjunction with a rare, harmonically numbered anniversary of nuclear atrocity. Now that the time has passed, the media is already going back to business as usual, running unvetted PR stories provided by the nuclear industry on energy, weaponry, and waste, with only rare published pushback coming from those of us who stand against all of it. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We look at the nuclear aspect of our world every week in depth, and especially now, with the coronavirus wreaking havoc on the safety of reactors, weapons, and radioactive waste, Nuclear Hot Seat is the only place you can count on to report the ongoing, evolving nuclear truth that the industry would rather we not hear about, let alone understand. I appreciate all of you who have been giving regular donations of $5 a week to the show. And I understand that COVID has hit you as hard as anyone else, which is why now I need further help to keep this show going. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation if you can. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button, which is where you can send a donation of any size, and you can also set up that monthly $5. Please do what you can now, and know that whatever you can do to help I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, for one of Nuclear Hot Seat's favorite people, Susie Snyder of Don't Bank on the Bomb. We've included Susie's under 2-minute explanation of the international grassroots Don't Bank on the Bomb campaign on many programs as kind of a PSA. Here, we let her go into much greater detail. If you're sincere about wanting to stop nuclear weapons, she gives you the details and the tools you need. Note that this interview is from May of 2018, but the updated 2019 Don't Bank on the Bomb report is available on their website, and everything she discusses is still accurate. By the way, this program includes a special surprise visit from an important new nuclear activist.
Susie Snyder, thank you so much for being with us here today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
First of all, what is PACS and what are the organization's goals?
Well, PACS is a Dutch peace organization, and what we're doing, we are working to reduce human suffering as a result of conflict. And so to prevent war, prevent suffering, and generally to make sure that we build norms that keep people safe and keep people alive.
What are some of your cornerstone programs? I'm certainly familiar with Don't Bank on the Bomb because I've followed that protocol with my own finances. What is this and how can people participate in it?
Don't Bank on the Bomb is a great project. What we do is we do three things. We examine the impact of the financial sector on companies that produce nuclear weapons. We name those companies, name them and shame them. And we encourage people to get in touch with their financial institutions so that they develop policies so that they don't have any exposure to these companies that do produce the key components for nuclear bombs. So it's naming the ones that have investments, it's supporting the ones that have great policies not to invest, and it's, of course, identifying the companies that make the bombs, because if we don't know who's doing it, we don't know what we can do about it.
Speaking of those companies, there has just been a new report that came out naming 28 separate companies as being involved in the manufacture of nuclear weapons. How did that report come about, and what are some of the findings you've made because of it?
Well, let me tell you, Libby, it was a good deal of research, and we are extremely rigorous in our research. So we've been looking at contracts and announcements for contracts, requests for proposals, and so on for the last 6 months. And so what we did is, as we looked at these, different issues, and we, I'm sure that many of your listeners also have children.
It's
they're hearing in the background.
Susie, this is the reason we do the work that we do. It's for the children and beyond. So this could not be more perfect.
It is just the reality, you know, working moms everywhere. Anyway, so what we did is we looked at the contracts, we looked at the government plans, different government plans for new types of nuclear weapons, for the weapons that are under these so-called modernization programs. And then we looked to see, okay, who's actually doing this in-house, so to speak? Like, what countries are doing it? There's only 9 countries that have nuclear weapons, right? It's not so many at the end of the day. And we look at who does stuff in-house using state-run agencies and who contracts out. Now, not everybody contracts out. Russia does stuff mostly in-house. North Korea does everything in-house. Pakistan does stuff in-house. But India, the US, the UK, France, they all hire external contractors. So then we follow the money. Who bids on the contracts? Who gets the contracts? And what are they doing? What are they actually doing under these contracts? And that's what we found exciting. Well, it's exciting in not a nice way, to be honest. But we found that, you know, we found over $116 billion in existing contracts right now for keeping nuclear weapons on the planet. And some of them until 2075, which all of these countries have said, their heads of state at one time or another said, no, we need a world without nuclear weapons. And I'll tell you, you don't get to a world without nuclear weapons by hiring Boeing or Raytheon or Lockheed Martin to build a new nuclear arsenal for you.
Some of the stories that I've read about coming out from the contracts are truly, it's like going into bizarro land. Give us some examples. For example, when the head of Raytheon was asked if there was a growth opportunity in the U.S. exit from the INF treaty.
So this is really surprising. I mean, okay, usually with nuclear weapons, nobody's really, at least nobody should be really proud to be making nuclear weapons. These are weapons designed to, you know, your listeners will know this already. These are weapons designed to annihilate cities. They're not for battlefields. They're not for strategic pinpoint accuracy. This is a city buster. And that's, I think that's really important to keep in mind. And for the most part, over the last, almost the last generation, people have been shying away from taking pride in this, but then there are a few. And there's been a slight change in the rhetoric around this. So when, you know, Donald Trump took office, he asked these questions, why would we have nuclear weapons if we could never use them? And he started saying, well, maybe we need, you know, we need to go back to make more and the biggest and the best weapons. And he's basically inciting an arms race. By withdrawing from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, this treaty from 1987 that prohibited an entire class of weapons, he opened the floodgates on this. And so in Raytheon, and Raytheon of all companies, Raytheon kind of was getting out of the nuclear arms game. It was seen as a losing interest. But then the withdrawal from the INF came about, and they said, oh, wait, we might have an opportunity here, at least in the short term. So you saw their investor relations call. They said, they were asked the question, oh, yeah, you know, is there any opportunity for us? And over the next quarter, Raytheon got $500 million in new contracts related to missile technology. So Raytheon's starting to cash in on this new nuclear arms race, and I just have to ask the question, what are they, you know, they're only looking for short-term gain. What are they looking for in the long term? Because this is not the kind of product that we should be supporting.
It's a terrifying thought that nuclear weapons are looked at as a growth industry and an opportunity for investor profits, when really their end game is the destruction of everything and their profits will mean nothing. There are other programs that have been brought up in the reading that I've been doing, and another one had to do with Boeing and a new program that the company that brought us the twice-crashed 737 MAX is being asked to develop. What is a flight termination receiver, and what are the implications of the attempt to develop it?
Okay, so this is something that within the nuclear policy community, there's some debate, right? So the flight termination receiver is, the idea is you can call the missile back, because it takes about, between 25 and 40 minutes for an intercontinental ballistic missile to be launched and hit its target. And that means that once you press the button, there's 2 hours until the end of civilization as we know it, because any target, they're going to see the incoming missile and they're going to launch in return. They're going to try to take everything out before you take out what they've got. There was this whole concept behind mutually assured destruction. So with what Boeing is doing now is they're making this new missile technology so that if you launch and you decide, oh, wait, whoops, our information was wrong. Oh, actually, it was a weather balloon. Oh, no, that wasn't an incoming missile. It was, you know, it was a pigeon. Whatever it is, and I don't mean to make light of it, but seriously, there's been so many near misses. It could be anything. The idea is that the missile would then go off course or would self-destruct. So it wouldn't have the same, it wouldn't hit its target. So the idea is to be able to shift it in flight. Now, on the one hand, you know, this could be great because then it, you know, it won't hit its target and you could stop some insanity. But on the other hand, if you see the missile coming in, you're going to fire with everything you've got. And so it's a losing situation. It's a losing proposition. And honestly, as you said, how much can we trust Boeing right now?
It's how much do we trust anybody who is working in nuclear arms because they can somehow justify it. I've also seen that one of the problems with having a flight termination receiver is that it might call for a launch of a weapon and then using it just as a scare tactic because they think, well, we can pull it back and there will be no harm, no foul, when indeed, you're right, the retaliation could be volleyed out before we could pull it back, and they might not be able to do so. And there goes the planet, or if not the planet, at least the people and the life forms on it.
Exactly. And what we've learned from new climate research, from new modeling over just the last 10 years, is that it doesn't take 1,000 bombs going off to destroy the civilization that we know. It would take 100 weapons between, for example, India and Pakistan, and 2 billion people. 2 billion people would be at risk of famine. It would cause grave environmental catastrophe. It would be a nuclear winter. And in the 80s, we were totally aware of this. We're like, okay, this is not going to happen. We're going to stop it. We're going to shut this down. This is insane. And right now, it's our time to stand up and say, hey, this is insane. There are so many more things that we could spend the money on. The U.S. government alone is spending $70,000 a minute on producing nuclear weapons. $70,000 a minute. Imagine what $70,000 a minute could do for public education, addressing climate change. The nuclear weapons problem, it's complicated, but it's a relatively easy fix. And it's just a matter of deciding to do it. And now's the time for people to demand that we do.
You know, you're right. On the one hand, it's a terribly depressing image for those of us who oppose nuclear and have managed to become conscious about it. Yet, in the intertwining of the private sector and nuclear weapons, there are potential points of leverage. Explain what you mean by that.
This is what I'm finding is very exciting. So 2 years ago, most of the nations in the world adopted a new treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. They said, you know what? This has gone bonkers long enough, and the consequences of any use of nuclear weapons are so grave, we need to prohibit everything to do with them. Prohibit all the making, having, using, preparing to use, prohibit it. Make it illegal. Make sure that we are collectively responsible if any weapons get used. You know, reinforce the non-proliferation standard by doing so. Protect the environment. This is so most governments in the world said, yes, we're going to do this. And after that, financial institutions, banks, pension funds, insurance companies, they said, wait a minute. If the weapons are illegal, the companies that are making the weapons, they're going to start to go down. Let's get out now. Let's prevent any reputational risk or regulatory risk. Let's end our financial involvement with these companies. And 10% of them dropped out. It was amazing.
When you said 10% of them dropped out, explain a little more about what that exactly means.
We've been doing this kind of analysis of the involvement of the financial sector and nuclear weapon producers for a while now, since 2013. And we track every year how many banks and how many financial institutions invest. And from the adoption of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons until a year later, there was a 10% reduction. In actual numbers, there was 30 fewer financial institutions that had investments in the companies that produced nuclear weapons. And some of these are really, like, this is Blue Cross and Blue Shield that previously had some investments and then got out. This is, you know, the Norwegian government pension funds that said, oh, wait a minute, we better change our relationship here. This is ABP, which is the fifth largest pension fund in the world. And they said, oh, hang on. Nope, nuclear is illegal now. Got to get out of that game, which is quite impressive. And we're putting together the numbers for this year. And I think we're going to see some additional positive change. Even though a few companies are starting to make money off of new contracts, in most of the world, this is seen as a bad investment.
I often think of PACS and the Nobel Peace Prize winning International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, which was behind the treaty in the United Nations, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. I often think of you two as kind of either conjoined or somehow being under the same umbrella. What is the relationship between the two groups?
PACS is a partner of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And ICAN is a campaign coalition, and we've got over 500 partners in more than 100 countries around the world. And it was ICAN working with these partnerships, also with concerned governments, with international organizations like the Global Red Cross, that got this treaty to happen. It was through partnership. It was through a movement. And PAX is a part of this bigger movement. We're really proud to be a member of this campaign coalition, because it means that we're, as we said in the local papers here, the Nobel Peace Prize got won in our little town, at least a little bit. It's quite amazing.
Let's switch over to talking a little bit about ICAN and the impact that that is having and can potentially have on the entire nuclear weapons landscape in the world. It is not a campaign to ask the 9 nuclear countries to get rid of their weapons. It's a campaign to get all of the countries that don't have nuclear weapons to agree to not get nuclear weapons. And then there are other provisions involved with it as well. Can you explain what those are and how those would mess up the nuclear countries?
Sure. So the thing is with ICAN is that we're working in over 100 countries to raise the stigma against nuclear weapons. And most countries of the world have already rejected nuclear weapons. It's just this 9 that seem to be a bit stuck and seem to be kind of it's a little bit of old thinking, and that doesn't quite relate to the current world order. But the ICAN is working even in the nuclear armed countries to say, hey, we have a plan to get to no nuclear weapons in the world. We know the nuclear armed countries, they're clearly not ready yet. They haven't quite matured to the level of many others to be able to take a more realistic and pragmatic approach to their security. But the other countries have. And so countries like Austria and Ireland, South Africa, are fully on board with this treaty because they recognize that there is no benefit to them and only risk from supporting nuclear weapons. What this means is that financial institutions in those countries have seen what happens with other weapons prohibitions, and they get out of the game when it comes to investing in companies that produce the weapons. Companies like Airbus. Airbus is a Dutch registered company. Airbus has operations throughout Europe. Airbus is known for making airplanes. Airbus also makes missiles for the French nuclear arsenal. And what this does is it says that if Airbus, for example, when Germany signs on to the Berne Treaty, the operations that Airbus has within Germany can't be involved in the production of missiles for France or for anybody else, because that's prohibited under the treaty. And that would change the landscape for France. France doesn't have another capability, or they have to move manufacturing capabilities. And that's really important. And also, the treaty also has this great impact because it makes the question of, it challenges the assumption that nuclear weapons benefit anyone's security, and in fact puts the onus on those who have the weapons to prove it. You've been saying this for so long with no evidence. You've been, you know, quite hysterical about your security concerns. No, be rational, be calm, prove that this is the only way forward. And if it is, in fact, the only way forward, why are you so united against other countries getting the same weapons? Why does North Korea use the same language as France in defending its decision to get nuclear weapons? You know, be a calm, rational actor in this field and not the hysterical nuclear-armed countries that we've come to know.
It seems that this program, the Treaty for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and the countries that sign on to it would really signify a grassroots erosion of the ability of the nuclear industry to operate unimpeded. In other words, putting perhaps, if not a block in the road, a stone in the shoe, that they can't move forward as they planned on it. And here in the U.S., we are starting to see some changes, at least on the state and the local level. In January, a bill was introduced in the Massachusetts state legislature that would require the state's pension funds to divest from nuclear manufacturers. The city of Cambridge has already done so, and here in California, OHI will not make any future investments in the makers or funders of nuclear weapons. Do you think that the best way for us to proceed is to work on the local grassroots level rather than going for the big guys in Washington, D.C. or the heads of whatever countries, people listening to this show in 123 countries that listen to it, not going after the top of the governmental food chain, but starting local is the path we need to follow?
Well, I think it depends on where people are. So in the U.S., you know, one out of every eight Americans lives in California. So when the California state legislature passes a resolution calling on the U.S. federal government to endorse and embrace the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, that is significant. And that is a demonstration of the will of the people. Nuclear weapons are the opposite of democracy. They are the opposite of people's movements, and it's going to take people's movements being creative in the locations they are to get change. We just had today, which said Berlin, both the city of Berlin as well as the federal state of Berlin come on board and call on the German government to join this treaty.
Oh, that's fabulous. I hadn't gotten that news yet.
Yeah, and it's happening every day. There are new cities joining. There's new state resolutions being discussed. There are conversations happening. And the key thing is, nuclear weapons are an anachronism, and we can move past them, but we have to talk about them. And we have to talk about them not just with our friends that it's comfortable to talk about them with. We have to talk about them in other places. And reach out, because I'll tell you, we ran a petition campaign a couple of years ago in the Netherlands. And what we found is that 9 out of every 10 people we asked said, of course we don't support nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are dumb. Wait, they're still a problem? I thought they were gone. Most people don't know. And as soon as they know, they think, oh my gosh, this is ridiculous. This is a problem of the 80s. Let's send it to the dustbin of history. That attitude and that emphasis and that enthusiasm is starting to catch like a wildfire throughout the world. And it will change the minds of those sitting in the high political offices. If you are friends with the head of state, by all means, call your buddy and tell them to get on board with this treaty. If, however, you are not friends with the head of state, think about other ways you can help support this effort to make nuclear weapons history.
That brings us to the practicalities. What are things that people on the ground can do, and what tools do you have? Because the research is extensive and it is impeccable. Everything is footnoted. Everything is accurate in it. Because we can't, our side can't afford to make mistakes. What do you have available that we can use to support anything that we are saying or doing on the ground?
Well, the first thing I would encourage your listeners to just sign up to our newsletter. We're constantly putting information out. It's at nuclearban.org. And there's tons of info there. Well, now, it depends, again, where people are. If you want to figure out how to make sure your personal finances are in no way connected to the companies that produce nuclear weapons, whether it be through your bank or through your pension investment or other things, we have checklists on our website for people to use. So just, you know, quickly scan the website, see if your bank's listed, send them a message. We have tools. You can directly send your bank a message. And a lot of people these days, myself included, do banking on our phones, right? Mobile banking is like the thing. And I encourage people all the time, pull out your phone, go to your banking app, and just send a message directly to your bank right now. And just say, hey, are we in any way connected to companies that produce nuclear bombs? When you ask that question through your mobile app, through walking into your local bank branch, whatever it is, you're starting a chain reaction of the good kind. The person on the other end probably has no idea. So they're going to have to ask somebody, is going to have to ask somebody, is going to have to ask somebody. We saw a number of financial institutions get out of this type of investment because people started asking questions on their Facebook profiles. And there's just like, oh, that's not good. We can't have this. Oh, wait, let's check. Okay, well, what's good? They divested first, and then they put into place a policy to make sure that they'll never have any kind of investments connected to nuclear weapon producers in the future. And it's part of their internal due diligence now. it wasn't a huge number of people that did this. It was three or four people that saw something in a newspaper, that saw a tweet, that heard something on the radio. And they took action. Because it truly is, as Margaret Mead said, it truly is a small handful of thoughtful and committed people that can change the world. And there are many people who would love the extra energy and attention. And the quick question, do we have anything to do with the nuclear bomb? If so, how can we avoid it? And we can, and we will.
The brilliance of this program is that any individual can make an enormous difference simply by taking a few steps that are already brilliantly strategized and plotted out and framed, as you have done, as the people with PACs have done, and I can as well. If you have any final thoughts to share with the listeners today, what would that be?
I would ask your listeners to tell a friend. Each one can reach one, and each one can teach one. And that is how we will get this change. And that is how we will be able to retire from working on nuclear weapon issues and put our energy into dealing with the new challenges that face a new century.
Susie Snyder, you have been doing brilliant work. I've been aware of your work since Helen Caldicott's conference. I believe it was 5 or 6 years ago. And the progress has been astonishing and breathtaking. I always report on any positive steps that we find out that have been taken by either PACs or ICANN on Nuclear Hot Seat, because we've got to get our new good news from somewhere. And it seems to come inordinately from these two groups.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you. It's always a great pleasure. And I really appreciate the opportunity today.
Susie Snyder of DontBankOnTheBomb.com. Take a look at the easy steps of the campaign, and you can do it yourself from home, over the phone, or Zoom. Something to keep us busy during these COVID times. Quick shout out and kudos to HiroshimaNagasaki75.org. This coalition delivered 20 hours of live stream programming to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Links up to their YouTube channel on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 477. And that includes the two segments that I was involved in, my conversation with Gender and Radiation's Mary Olson, and my own piece on how not understanding radiation was hardwired into the start of the atomic age. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 11, 2020. Don't miss a single episode by going to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, and signing up in the yellow opt-in box to get one email a week with a link to each week's show and a short description of what's in it. And if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with a date that it's over, because once it starts, it is never over. There you go. That is your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.